Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous and Powerful. Nancy Gibbs, Michael Duffy, both of Time Magazine, and the President's Club. Uncommon Knowledge Now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to visit us on our website at hoover.org/UK or on Facebook at facebook.com/UNCKnowledge, facebook.com/UNCKKnowledge. Today, journalists and authors Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy. Deputy Managing Editor of Time Magazine, Nancy Gibbs joined the magazine in 1985 and has written, this is a staggering fact, has written more than 150 cover stories. You know what that makes you? That makes you the real thing. It makes you the real thing. Executive Editor of Time Magazine, Michael Duffy, joined the magazine on the same day in 1985, as I just learned, and he has served as Time's Pentagon Correspondent and Washington Bureau Chief, and is now your current title?
Executive Editor
overall.
Okay. That's right.
But you're in Washington.
Yes, sir.
All right. Ms. Gibbs and Mr. Duffy co-authored the 2007 bestseller, The Preacher and the President's Billy Graham in the White House. Their new book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Nancy and Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
Segment one, The Club. The President's Club describes relationships among sitting and former presidents from Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover to Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. I want to have you tell stories because the book is full of wonderful stories. But first, in researching the book, what most surprised you?
Almost everything surprised us. And we've been writing about presidents for going on 20 years.
Since 1985.
Since 1985. Right. But because we've always looked at them one at a time, you know, as individuals on the global stage, we had never looked at them in relationship, certainly not in relationship to one another. And so we saw all of them completely differently than we ever had before.
I think one of the things that surprised me is that presidents from different parties have tended in general to get along a little better, both in office and afterward, with presidents of the other party than have presidents of the same party, which I find that there are lots of different reasons for this, but it's not what I expected. How much they all help each other surprised me. They all try to help each other. How much rivalry there is between them, even when they're sometimes helping, caught me a little by surprise. So overall, I think this is a group that that cares and worries and watches each other a lot, but I think that they also are fiercely protective of the presidency itself more than the person.
And you make the argument in this book that that started early. Quote, the President's Club was founded by George Washington thanks to the second best decision he ever made. Nancy, explain that one.
Well, you know, becoming president in the first place was probably the best decision in the interest of the country, accepting the job. And he probably could have done it for life. And so everything Washington did set a precedent for everyone who followed. And the fact that he limited himself to two terms, decided to become an ex-president, was one of the most important precedents. And then, of course, because John Adams needed still the luster around this great military commander, when he asked Washington, will you come back and command the armed forces again, Washington agreed, which therefore set the premise that former presidents can be very useful to their successors. And we saw that starting from the very beginning of the Republic.
Right. And the President's Club, the title of this book that you describe, takes shape after the Second World War, really. You're starting with Harry Truman at the end of the Second World War. And you describe more or less a founding moment of this modern President's Club. Herbert Hoover and Harry Truman attend the inauguration of Dwight Eisenhower. Harry Truman, of course, ceases to be president at noon that day. Mm-hmm. The President's Club, quote, I think we ought to organize a former President's Club, Hoover suggested to Truman. Fine, Truman replied, you be the president of the club, and I will be the secretary, close quote. So what follows from that exchange?
It's almost...
It's not exactly just a pleasantry, is it?
No, and they don't go out and immediately build a clubhouse. But over the next 20 to 30 years, we see a steady accretion of benefits of being in the club. Eisenhower gives them, for starters, a better pay raise. Johnson gives them, you know, Secret Service protection. By the time Richard Nixon becomes president, he actually creates a building where they can work and spend the night because he's so tired in 1969 of having Lyndon Johnson call and say, I need a place to stay, I need a plane, I need an office when I come to town. So he turns to a young military aide to say, find them a building, find them a place for these men who have so much to offer to give. And that aide, who turns out to be named Brent Scowcroft, finds a building on Lafayette Square and creates a clubhouse, which is still there to this day, unmarked.
And still used for the same purpose.
And recently upgraded to a point where the thread count on the beds, I just got in about 2 weeks ago to see this, it's better than the Four Seasons. This is a very nice place to stay, Peter. Unfortunately, only four people can check in.
I see. Okay. Again, before we get to specific stories, just help me place this book. You've got a lot of wonderful stories here. You also have some analysis. So let's say on a spectrum with a Time Warner product, with People magazine at one end of the spectrum and the Journal of the American Historical Association at the other end of the spectrum, where does the President's Club, where would you like people to think of this book?
That's a great question.
It's a great question. And like all things, we hope it's right in the middle. We don't want it to be one or the other. We hope it's a convergence both of a historical something, peculiarity. I think, you know, other countries elect presidents from all of sort of, look at France. They elect patrician, grandfatherly, dead center, not particularly pro-American presidents, except for Sarkozy, who was obviously the odd man out. Americans elect presidents from all walks of life. They elect Jimmy Carter and George Herbert Walker Bush. They elect Barack Obama, and they elect, Ronald Reagan. There's a wide variety of presidents. And one of the things we found sort of fundamentally American about who Americans elect is there's no club that would have all these guys. Most foreign countries have presidents who come from the same clubs, right?
They don't need a president's club.
They were born and raised in sort of the same environments. But Americans have elected presidents from across the entire spectrum of our experience. We're a motley mud of a country. And the club shows that. It shows us that we look to all kinds of different leaders. And we have to judge them over the broad span of time. So I think there are great stories about these men and the humanity, but there's also common stories about the power of this office, the importance of making sure that it doesn't fade, and how they all come out of it with scars and regrets and as well as triumphs.
I love the idea. I hadn't thought of it this way, but I love the idea. I'm just underscoring this. You said it, Michael, so that you use it in future interviews. But I love the idea that the only club to which all of these men could belong is the one they formed themselves, because Lyndon Johnson could never have gotten into the Chevy Chase Club, for example.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Segment two. Let's start then. Ike, JFK, and LBJ. April 1961, the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, from the President's Club. Quote, when President Kennedy's men were pressed in the months and years that followed to explain the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion, most of them said that presidents inherit the foreign policy of their predecessors, close quote. In other words, Schlesinger and Goodwin and Sorensen and all of this, Salinger all said it was Eisenhower's fault. Okay. Very briefly, what was the Bay of Pigs invasion? Why did the Kennedy people claim they inherited it from Eisenhower? And what was Ike's reaction?
So before Kennedy was elected in the spring of 1960, there had been meetings in the White House about what to do about Cuba. And the initial conversations, the planning for an alternative government and for the possibility of various courses of action had started. And Eisenhower's aides warned him, things like this have a way of taking on a life of their own. And Eisenhower responded, well, not as long as I'm in charge. And the aides said, yes, exactly. The problem was that once you start planning for something like an invasion like this, once Eisenhower left office, it had constituencies who were promoting it, behind it. And so one of the reasons that the Kennedy team felt as though the Bay of Pigs was already well underway, this whole plan to use these exile forces to invade Cuba, was because it had actually started, the planning had started during the Eisenhower administration.
Critical point, though. Eisenhower never said, do it.
No. And in fact, you could argue that the way Eisenhower's decision-making structure in the White House had been set up, he never would have. Certainly nothing like the way that it was executed. But, and this is what's very tricky, every president, especially a president like Eisenhower, who is an enormous military hero, how hard would it be for a new president, the youngest president in a century, whose, you know, executive experience was being a PT boat commander, how does he overrule what he thinks he has inherited from the great general? And so almost, even though Eisenhower...
when John Kennedy says in the inaugural address, the torch has passed to a new generation, Eisenhower guys are saying to themselves, yes, and that's the problem.
Well, I'm sure that they were, although the plan, of course, the actual invasion plans changed considerably in the months before the April invasion. And so the whole thing goes horribly wrong, and it's a fiasco in the entire world.
So Cuban exiles attempt an invasion of Cuba. The invasion fails. They're pinned down on the beach. The United States does not send in air support that they seem to have been. It's all a catastrophe. John Kennedy calls Ike and asks for support.
He takes responsibility for it.
Right.
But he wants to talk to Eisenhower. And partly he wants to talk to Eisenhower because he wants the photograph. And many people have seen this famous photograph of the two men walking
Camp
the paths
David,
of Camp David. Right. First time Kennedy had ever been to Camp David.
It's in the book. All
right. It is there.
And Eisenhower sort of takes him to the woodshed and, you know, drills him about, you know, so did you have everyone in the room at the same time? Did you hear competing points of view? And did the Joint Chiefs really sign off on this plan? And at one point, Kennedy says to him, you know, no one knows how tough this job is until you've been in it for a few months. And Eisenhower says, forgive me, Mr. President, I tried to tell you that a few months ago.
Now, in the rewrite of this by the legions of the Kennedy forces, it was widely blamed on the previous administration. But what we discover in the book is how when Kennedy comes in, he completely throws out the Eisenhower decision-making process. He thinks it's too hierarchical and too military, and he goes to a kind of, you know, hub of a wheel system, which is completely unsuited for the modern presidency. Many presidents have discovered this. And what I think the real outcome of both the conversation at Camp David and the Bay of Pigs is that Kennedy then shifts. He realizes he has to go back to a more Eisenhower-like decision-making process on foreign policy, which he then has in place by the time he gets to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And what's so striking to me is that Eisenhower is reading the Riot Act to this 42, 43-year-old man at this point. He keeps it private.
He does.
He knows that they're leaking to the press saying this was Eisenhower's plan. He knows that, and yet he keeps it private. He is publicly either mute or supportive of his successor.
He waves off congressional Republicans. He says, I don't want any witch hunting. And this is a classic sort of piece of club protocol that Eisenhower, as much as he disagreed with Kennedy, he thought the whole thing had been a disaster, that it would not be good for America at that moment.
You liked Ike. The more you read about him, the more you liked Ike, right, Nancy?
Yeah, I found him a fascinating, fascinating figure.
Okay, so, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and then he comes back to play in ways we never expected, and you can get to this later, in politics, particularly in Republican Party politics, as you get into the campaigns of the mid-1960s. I never expected when we started this book to be ending up writing a chapter about that.
Okay, we'll get to that. I want to stick with Ike and Kent, because this contrast between this titanic figure who by now is an elderly gentleman, Eisenhower, and this gorgeous young but inexperienced figure is fascinating. So Cuban Missile Crisis, October 1962, and here we have John Kennedy in a speech that Theodore Sorensen, whom we all knew, wrote.
All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
A full retaliatory response on the Soviet Union, perhaps the tensest moment throughout the Cold War. Dwight David Eisenhower's advice to John Fitzgerald Kennedy at this moment.
They talk the morning of that speech. And Kennedy, of course, has no way of knowing for sure whether he is about to set in motion a series of events that will lead to World War III. And he calls Eisenhower and he basically says, what do you think Khrushchev's going to do? Do you think he's going to fire these missiles? Do you think he's going to move on Berlin? Because he's really only one other person in the world who knows what it's like to have a decision of that weight on his shoulders. And Eisenhower says, you know, he doesn't think so. He's fairly reassuring. But there's a sort of, you know, Kennedy ends the call basically saying, well, hang on tight. And it was that level of tension at that moment that very, very few people could understand. And I think it was, you know, reassuring to Kennedy to hear Eisenhower, who had had to spend his presidency assessing Soviet intentions and making the same kinds of calculations, that not only would Eisenhower support Kennedy's decision in public, but that in private it was the right one.
I have to quote this, and it's exactly – here it is. Eisenhower says in retirement, "The United States never lost a soldier or a foot of ground in my administration," he said in retirement. "We kept the peace. People asked how it happened. By God, it didn't just happen. I'll tell you that," close quote. That's what he understood. That's what he's telling John Kennedy. They have this even when you achieve peace, when you achieve a certain serenity, which Eisenhower did, behind the scenes, you're working hard, taking risks.
And they understand that each – once they get done with the job and they have some time to reflect on it, they all understand that they all had to make decisions that no one else can possibly really comprehend because they were the only people at the table and had to make them. George Herbert Walker Bush told us at one point, he goes, when we get together as a group, we know what we did. We don't have to go into great detail and justify it to each other because we know what it's like to have been there. A thing that reminded me about the Kennedy-Ike relationship was a comment someone who had worked for both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush made to us after he'd worked for both men very closely, very senior. And he said, when you get into the job, particularly at the start, you have three reactions. The first is, oh boy, I've been set up. The second is, maybe the guy before me wasn't so wrong after all. And the third reaction is, who am I going to talk to about this? Who else can understand it? And so when Kennedy reaches out to Ike at that key moment in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we see something that takes place again and again and again over the next 40 and 50 years, where a sitting president will say, my advisors, good as they are, haven't sat in this chair. I need somebody who has to explain, to talk to.
One last Ike vignette. The book is full of this, but this one I found astonishing. John Kennedy is assassinated. Dwight Eisenhower comes to the White House to pay his respects to the body of the slain president and then has lunch with the new president. And if you stop there and say to yourself, what would that lunch have been like? My guess would have been pretty tense because Dwight Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson, Lyndon Johnson had been to war, but he faked his combat record. He was in many ways everything that Dwight Eisenhower would have disliked in a man. Grandiloquent, power-hungry, boastful, loud, brash. And instead, tell what happens at that lunch.
Well, those two men, of course, also had quite a history together because all through Eisenhower's presidency, or through most of it, Johnson's majority leader, right, and a lot of Eisenhower's legislative success came from his ability to find common cause with Sam Rayburn, with Johnson. They would call themselves, you know, as three Texans have to stick together. So, you know, it wasn't that Eisenhower particularly trusted Johnson, but
they found a way to work together.
But they had found a way to work together. And on the night of Kennedy's assassination, Johnson had called him and said, I need you, which is what inspired Eisenhower to get in the car the next day.
And drive to D.C.
Drives to Washington, sees the body, comes to see Johnson. And he ends up writing out on a legal pad what he thinks Johnson needs to say to a joint session of Congress in order to – that he would call 5 days later. This is what you need to tell the country.
Lyndon, you need to call a joint session of Congress, and here's what you need to say. Somebody get me a pad of paper.
Yeah, exactly. And even more, you know, he remembered the name of a secretary he had worked with, and he asked if she could come and type up the notes and then make two copies, one for him, one for Johnson, destroy everything else. He did not want this to be known.
Former Johnson aide first told us about this, and 40 or 50 years later, you could see that it still kind of rankled this man, who was by now in his 70s or 80s, Johnson had turned to Ike for advice at that moment. Yet I think the most amazing thing about that incident is that what Ike told Johnson to do was to push through the Kennedy agenda. So here, because he thought that by doing that, it would restore the power of sort of some kind
it
of
would signal continuity, signal continuity, and stability.
And so you have a Republican who probably disagreed with absolutely everything in that agenda, telling the new Democratic president to push through in order to send a signal of continuation.
Segment three. Let's jump forward about 20 years. Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan. I love this moment. In 1981, President Reagan, new president at that point, asks former presidents Ford and Carter, both of whom he'd caused trouble. He'd almost defeated Gerry Ford in the 1976 Republican primary, and he had defeated Carter for the presidency in 1980. He asks them both to represent the United States at the Cairo funeral of Anwar Sadat. And what happens on the flight to Egypt? Quote, the President's Club. Gerry Ford and Jimmy Carter disliked each other until they discovered that they both disliked Ronald Reagan even more. Who wants that one?
Michael? I'll take it, yes. The President's Club owes its modern rejuvenation to Ronald Reagan because he was smart enough to say, it's really not wise for me to go to this funeral, and it really was not
wise. It was not long after the assassination attempt on Reagan's
life. It was only 5 or 6 months, and people did not know then how close he had come at that point to not surviving that, and they didn't want to send Herbert Walker Bush. So they came up with a very clever idea to send the previous three presidents, who did not care for each other either. These were not men who were full of love.
Richard Nixon is also on this.
Nixon and just Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. In addition, just to make
no the plane is long
no,
enough.
No, no, this is the old 707. This is the old Air Force One. It's a very
no
cramped
place to hide.
Space, not much bigger than this table. Plus Al Haig and Henry Kissinger, just to make it interesting. And they get up there, and they get on board, and they come to the White House. They all arrive. They have a brief meeting with Reagan. So it's the first time in a century that there are four presidents in the room. In fact, George Bush is also in the room, so you could say it was five. They get back on board. They fly to Cairo. Nixon peels off to do his own secret mission, which was typical, and not even the White House knew about that. But on the way back, Ford and Carter, who tangled very badly in 1976, actually become friends. Nixon has left the plane. They're alone up front. They start complaining about how hard it is to start a presidential library and raise money. They both had tangled with Ronald Reagan in different ways. You know, Reagan nearly beat Ford, and Reagan did beat Carter. But I think they also realized in the club, which then was pretty big, you had Nixon, Ford, Carter, that they might be stronger, the two of them together. And over the next 25 years, these two men would do about 24 projects together. Sometimes with fanfare, sometimes not. And within a decade, they both promised Ford and Carter to give the eulogy at the other person's funeral, depending on who died first. Mm-hmm. So, surprising.
You write that Ford and Carter would create a place all their own, a powerful, productive club inside the club.
Yeah, I think both of them had been thrown out of office earlier than either would have imagined. They both were looking at really long post-presidential careers.
Right.
Ford was the second longest when he died to Hoover, who survived for 31 years. And in September of this year, Jimmy Carter becomes the longest living former president. So they had to create second careers. They knew that their place within the club was very uncertain because Ford was sort of an accidental president to start with, and Carter clearly was an anomaly as the country was moving to the right in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Right. Nixon and Reagan. Personally, for me, this is just endlessly fascinating. I do three shows on this alone. Both Californians, both Republicans, but profoundly different kinds of men. One, Ronald Reagan, always at ease with himself. Richard Nixon, you get the feeling he was never quite at ease with himself. Actually, if I may indulge myself, they'll cut it out. Bill Buckley told me a story, which I thought the two of you might enjoy as I was reading the book. 1967, and Nixon is in New York practicing law. Ronald Reagan's governor of California, but Nixon doesn't know him. So he calls Bill Buckley to the apartment to tell him about his friend, Bill Buckley's friend, Ronald Reagan. Three people in the room, Bill Buckley, former Vice President Richard Nixon, and John Mitchell, who's there to take notes. And Bill Buckley said he talked about Ronald Reagan, and he concluded by saying, Mr. Vice President, to Richard Nixon, what you need to know about Ronald Reagan is he's the only man I've ever met who really and truly doesn't care what the New York Times writes about him. And Richard Nixon said, I don't give a good goddamn what the New York Times writes about me either. Do I, John?
It's a great story.
There you have the two men. All right. You write in the President's Club, Ford may have pardoned Nixon, but it was Reagan who put Nixon back in the game. Close quote.
It's true. By the time Ronald Reagan becomes president, Nixon and Reagan have now had almost a 30-year relationship. The two men meet in 1947. They court each other in the 1960 election. It's because of Nixon that, well, partly because of Nixon that, while he's campaigning for Nixon as, and during the governor's race in 1962, that Ronald Reagan finally says, "Okay, I'm going to stop being a Democrat. I'm going to become a Republican." He's actually giving a speech at a Nixon fundraiser when he converts and signs the papers.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And one of my favorite details about their relationship is that when Nixon finally got the nomination in 1968, having essentially beat a number of people, including Reagan, who was sort of campaigning but not really.
Three-week campaign.
A number of people on Reagan's, on Nixon's campaign staff really pushed Nixon to make Reagan the vice president, the vice presidential nominee, for the same reason that you just – that Buckley – you mentioned about Buckley, which is that he said that choosing Ronald Reagan would so upset the Eastern establishment that it would be absolutely the most important thing Nixon could do, because he could push away from that set and show that he was understanding a Republican Party that was moving south and west.
Right.
Nixon wouldn't do it. For most of Nixon's presidency, he keeps Reagan at a remove. But by the time Reagan becomes president...
If I may say, yes. Reagan stuck up for Nixon long and late during Watergate. Isn't that right?
He did. Yeah. The two men worked very closely together and had a correspondence all through Nixon's presidency. But then comes Watergate, and he is exiled, and he and Carter and Ford won't have anything to do with him. And so when Reagan is finally nominated and is about to be sworn in, Nixon starts writing his letters. And the letters are single-spaced, and they're long. And it's about who to appoint, and it's about how to start, and what to prioritize, and when to get sleep, and when to vacation, and what to eat, and where to go first, and where not to go first. I mean, he's scripting a large blueprint for Reagan. And Reagan spends – he doesn't take it all, the advice, but he takes a bunch of it.
He reads it all.
He reads it all.
He takes it seriously.
That's right.
The President's Club, quote, "If there was one topic that dominated the Nixon-Reagan correspondence, it was how to manage the U.S.-Soviet relationship. Nixon worked behind the scenes and often in public to undermine Gorbachev's reformist image, warning that no matter how appealing and friendly Gorbachev may seem, he was nonetheless a classic Soviet apparatchik." Close quote. Explain that.
Well, Nixon and Reagan had completely different attitudes about foreign policy. We think of them both as Southern California. Some people may think of them as just Southern California Republicans. But when it came to foreign policy, they were night and day. Nixon, who may have started as a communist hunting, red baiting, Republican, is a detentist by the time he's in his prime in the 70s. But Reagan looked at that and said, "You're just apologizing for the Soviet Union. You're forgiving them. You're not trying to get rid of them. You're just trying to contain them. I want to get rid of them." I think at the core of the Reagan presidency, and maybe the core of what Ronald Reagan stands for, was about, I think, bringing down the Soviet Union and getting rid of communism. So he quietly, politely, never really bought that part of Nixon's whole foreign policy or his administration. So by the time Reagan becomes president, Reagan wants to push this very hard. And Nixon is reluctant to be as radical in his approach to the Soviets as Reagan is inclined to be. Reagan is personally in all their leaders' face, whether it's Brezhnev or eventually Gorbachev. And Nixon is much more reluctant to embrace that kind of change in American foreign policy.
So the strange paradox, in my judgment, it's not only interesting, it's basic to understanding what happened during the 80s, to the end of the Cold War. Richard Nixon, there's no doubt that he's a patriot. There's no doubt that but in some way, he's more suspicious of Gorbachev, but in some fundamental way, more conservative about the U.S.-Soviet relationship. And Reagan somehow recognizes right away that Gorbachev is a different kind of leader, and we have an opening here. We have a moment when we can get it over. We can end it.
Isn't
it's astounding.
It's so typical, though, about these two men and what we know about their sense of the possible.
Yes.
And in so many ways, Nixon, as shrewd a chess player as he was globally, his sense of what was possible, this sort of epic notion of good and evil and right and wrong and this larger triumph, I think was not the way Nixon thought. And so for Reagan to imagine that what ended up happening could happen, I think.
And yet Reagan is using Nixon. He's checking his own perceptions. He wants the detailed assessments.
He's using him as a guy who can go overseas.
Folks, on my judgment, the Nixon-Reagan relationship is worth the price of the book alone.
But there's more, as they say. I feel like Ron Popeil. It slices, it dices. Segment four, back to Carter and Ford. The special case of James Earl Carter Jr., the President's Club. Quote, Carter gave the club a great gift, something for all the others to complain about.
Well, every club needs a black sheep. It's what it sort of binds the members together. And, you know, Carter was a loner when he was in the White House. It's, you know, that's so much a part of his personality. It's very, he's not someone that you think of as being a clubby guy. And so each of the presidents who followed had a complicated relationship to manage with him. On the one hand, there were valuable missions that he could and did undertake for all of them that were sort of sensitive diplomatic missions that required someone with the stature and the relationships Carter had with foreign leaders.
And the deniability to go over and talk to some people.
On the other hand, you could never count on Carter to stay on script. And so it was, you know, they each sort of have to calculate whether or not, you know, at one point Bill Clinton, he's about to send Carter on a mission to Haiti, when he turns to Stephanopoulos and he says, "I'm going to send Carter. You think that's okay, don't you? You know, is he going to play nice?" So,
quote,
he was complicated.
In late 1990, Carter secretly and repeatedly lobbied the United Nations Security Council and other foreign leaders to vote against a resolution proposed by President Bush. This is George W. Bush, authorizing the use of force to remove Saddam from Kuwait. Carter's behavior, several former Bush advisors said later, bordered on treason. Close quote. The sitting commander-in-chief is doing all he can to ready the nation for war, and his predecessor, James Earl Carter Jr., is doing all he can to undercut him.
To ready the world for, I mean, to put together an incredibly complicated coalition to support his policy to expel Saddam from Kuwait, yes.
And Carter did exactly what you said, and he did it secretly, and the White House found out about it, and they quickly made it known to him that they were on to his game, his letter-writing campaign. Did that stop President Carter? No. He went out and then started lobbying the Arab members of the Arab League. What was motivating Carter here to take on George Herbert Walker Bush, with whom he had the best relationship of any of the presidents who followed? He didn't get along with Reagan that well, but Bush had put him to work in some other places, and things had turned out pretty well. So why would he take on the patron with whom he had had the best? Amazing question. I think two things. One. Carter did come out of his own presidency with one clear, unalloyed win, and
that was
Camp David. Mm-hmm. And so he felt that he was the man.
He knew the Middle East.
He knew the Middle East, right. And I also think he just misread George Herbert Walker Bush. He thought that, you know, he'd gone to – Bush had sent him to Panama, and he nearly had helped sort out some elections there with Manuel Noriega. And then he saw Bush go and invade and expel him. And I think that – Carter got it in his head somehow that Bush would not stop in Kuwait and would go all the way, and that was what he was worried about.
I see.
It was a complete misreading of what Bush was up to, and I think everyone knew it. I remember reporting it at the time. We weren't going any further than Kuwait. So that issue would come back, of course, but those two men after that were never the same, Bush and Carter.
In 1994, Bill Clinton sends Jimmy Carter on a fact-finding mission to North Korea. The President's Club. Yes, right. The President's Club. Quote, this was simply bizarre. Rather than serving discreetly as Clinton's envoy, Carter was negotiating in public. He's on television. Negotiating in public for a deal of his own and explaining to the world what Clinton had to do next. Close quote.
Peter,
that sat well with Bill Clinton.
Peter, it's really important that no one come away from hearing about the President's Club thinking that they just sit around and sing Kumbaya.
Right.
There are lots of rivalries and lots of difficult moments. This isn't the first time someone has claimed treason. You know, it happened during the late 60s between Johnson and Nixon, too. But Carter, as he remakes his second career and becomes this global, globe-trotting, you know, one-man, you know, peace negotiator, it becomes indispensable in a way in this. Clinton, Bush II, and Obama have all now in this past 20 years sent him to North Korea at one time or another. And each time it's fraught. When he goes for Clinton, he does sort of unravel the knot that needs to be unraveled, but he goes far past what he was asked to do, and he announces it on CNN before he even has a chance to talk to the president. The same, almost same thing happens when Clinton sends him to Haiti a few months later, and a lot of people in Clinton's White House said, you're not going to do this again. You're not. Please tell me you're not going to do this again. By the time Barack Obama sends Jimmy Carter to North Korea in 2010. The Obama campaign, which has a few lawyers, or the Obama White House, which has a few lawyers on its staff, made him sign a 12-point agreement and sign it, making him swear not to do any of the things that he had done before. That's not in the book, but it came out in the Time story that accompanied
really?
Its release. Yeah.
Raising the interesting question, just who would have standing to sue and in what court if you violated point 6 of 12? But still.
One of the points
the club
was,
has its own military tribunal.
I see. In the basement of the Brownstone
that's
on Lafayette Square.
That's the next
Square.
Book, the club tribunal.
Okay. The impeachment of Clinton and Gerald Ford's attempt to help out the President's Club. Quote, 5 days after Christmas 1998, Clinton picked up the phone and called Ford, the most unusual club negotiation since Ford pardoned Nixon, then commenced. Who wants to tell that story?
Well, you know, what's amazing is, of course, Ford's decision to pardon Nixon, which, you know, certainly haunted him, but which he felt was the right thing for the country, that the only way the country could move forward was if he restored the honor of the presidency, if he occupied the office and could get on with an agenda and not have the entire government and world just watching a trial. And so now you fast forward to 1998, and we're now going through the prospect of another whole impeachment trial. It is not that Gerald Ford wants to save Bill Clinton's skin. He just thinks, and again, it's very much the way the club thinks, this would be bad for the presidency. Right. It would be bad for the office. And so he wants to find some way out of this that it, short of an extended trial. And so he's trying to negotiate privately behind the scenes with all parties of, is there a way to come to an agreement about a censure deal? And he says to Clinton, Bill, you know, I think you're going to have to admit that you lied. And
amazing conversation between a former president and a president. But I'm not even sure anyone in the White House or Clinton's own staff had that conversation with him. But the former president could, because he had nothing to lose and had the stature to say, this is about something bigger than you or me. This is about moving forward. And here's a man who was the expert in moving forward, so much so that he lost his presidency probably in way over it. So in the end, Clinton didn't take the deal, but boy, Ford was trying to get it.
Segment 5, Clinton, the Bushes, and Barack Obama. Bush and Bush, the President's Club, quote, in all families, some things are just better left unsaid. In the Bush family, the subjects that were off limits sometimes included their two presidencies, close quote. Now, this so cuts against the notion that the father is advising the, either that the son, George W. Bush, is doing what his father tells him to do, or precisely the opposite notion also has some currency, that the son, George W. Bush, is defining himself against his father.
We didn't find either very convincing. I never bought the first because I think maybe it's because I have three sons. But I never bought the first, and I always thought the second was a notion that was true in some ways about perhaps a few domestic policy things. I think George W. Bush watched his father's presidency and decided that he'd lost control of the conversation about taxes, and that wasn't going to happen again. And he'd lost control of his party, you know, when he was president, and that wasn't going to happen again. But that was what anyone would have concluded from that presidency.
You didn't have to be a political scientist or a son.
Or a son,
or even a Republican.
Right.
Right? So that didn't seem to be you know, clubs are complicated. Families are even more complicated. I think we all know that. What we were struck by, I was struck by, were two things in particular. One is that when the Gulf War II begins, what we see between father and son over and over is not advice being either given and listened to or given and not heard. There's no evidence of that. What their evidence is of the father being in a kind of keen agony about the criticism of the son, as any father would have been.
And an agony over, because as any former president would be, knowing what it feels like to order soldiers into battle.
Right.
And knowing what an unbelievable burden that is.
41 talked about when he ordered troops into Panama. That was his first encounter in 1989, late 89. He said that he lay in bed that night paralyzed, physically paralyzed.
Unable to move.
So I think he knew what his son was going through in ways that most of us don't. I think he also knew that Bush, too, had lots of advisors. But he only had one dad.
Right. Well, okay, so let me ask you then the next.
What's one?
George H.W. Bush leaves his son alone, gives him fatherly support and understanding, broadly speaking, right? Okay.
That's right.
Not that there aren't good stories about that in the book, but Brent Scowcroft,
who's very close to Bush the Elder, James Addison Baker III, who is very close to Bush the Elder, and did you not, you were in Washington, did you not get the feeling that the father's closest advisors were beside themselves, not just standing back and trying to be understanding, but that they were trying to play in Washington and nudge policy in one direction or another?
I thought Scowcroft more than Baker. I think Scowcroft's words were a little more pointed and timed. But I didn't conclude.
And Scowcroft actually went public.
He did.
It was a couple of columns.
There were two. And on television once. But what I didn't conclude from that was that simply because Baker and Scowcroft were speaking out, that they were speaking for the father. I think they were opposed. The notion, however, widely ascribed by people I mean, I covered Bush for 4 years. I don't think that meant that 41 was secretly holding. I think he had some doubts and misgivings, and there's some evidence of that. But that didn't mean that he wanted that out or was going to ever express it. What I thought it meant, there's plenty of evidence on the record, both in Condi Rice's book and in George W. Bush's book, that they did not find Scowcroft's comments helpful. But I don't think that meant that they thought that that's what the father
was going to
know. And in fact, I think at one point, Bush the son asked his father, "What's with Brent?" And what 41 says, "Brent's a friend. I'm not going to criticize Brent." and in the world of friendships, and George Herbert Walker Bush has a gazillion very close friends. No one is closer. That doesn't mean he was speaking for 41. It meant that 41 was not going to then disagree with him.
Right.
He wasn't going to come.
Nancy, will you indulge me in a little counterfactual here? I couldn't help. George W. Bush, during this administration, the war goes well for 3 weeks and then it goes badly, or at least let's say it goes sideways for 4 years. And you've got Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, crosswise of Colin Powell at the State Department. You've got the CIA leaking over and over again against its own administration. If Dwight David Eisenhower had been around to offer advice to young George W. Bush, as he was around to offer advice to young John Fitzgerald Kennedy, what might he have said?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And, of course, there's no way to answer it, except if you think about what Johnson heard from Eisenhower about Vietnam. Eisenhower was very much of the mind that if you're going to do something, do it, and not to fight with half measures. And so that it's damaging to your credibility, it's damaging to your own soldiers' morale, and your enemy, if they're at all smart, knows they can wait you out. And so if there is an extension to be drawn from that, it would be that he would have seen the surge as the necessary next step, that it's you have to sort of be all in. Would you say that?
Well, Nancy's one of Nancy's really my favorite chapters is where Johnson invites Eisenhower in on key Vietnam meetings, Peter,
right.
And he lets Ike run them.
Right. This is astonishing.
He lets Ike run these meetings.
This is absolutely astonishing.
And which is unthinkable now that you have a former president. They're very sensitive about the role former presidents play right to this day. But Johnson was like, "You're my best chief of staff." He was sending helicopters up to Gettysburg every week with plans and latest ideas. And Eisenhower would mark them up and send them back down. And he really was kind of functioning as a field marshal. And then eventually Johnson would have him in and Ike would run the meetings. Ike was much more of a hawk as a former president than he was as a president. He was much more careful.
What he got very impatient with was feeling that Johnson was trying to hide the true extent, nature, and cost of the war because – and there's obvious truth to this – because it would interfere with the domestic
agenda. What about
–
again, I'm indulging myself a little bit here. But on the other hand, the book is so rich that it not only what's here is wonderful, but what – it suggests might have been it gives you enough information so you can begin to play historical games, which is fascinating in itself, I think. But one question, you interviewed Bill Ewald, who was a very young speechwriter in the Eisenhower White House and whom I know. And he made the point that in those days, the White House staff was, of course, smaller than it is now. And the man who presided over the staff meeting every morning was Dwight David Eisenhower. And so I was just wondering, you get this feeling, Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, Powell at and would Eisenhower have said to George W. Bush, "Mr. President, get these jokers in a room and sort it out"? I get that sort of an impulse, I feel. Is that fair or am I being unfair to both?
I don't think the secretaries of those agencies would have behaved in the 1950s, the way we have come to watch them behave in the 1980s, 1990s, and now. I think it's just it's too many power centers.
And I don't think any president brought to – I mean, remember, the first office Eisenhower ever ran for was president.
Right.
And no president has come to office, other than maybe George Washington, has come to office with the kind of stature and standing, not just in the country but in the world,
right,
that Eisenhower had. And he still had it when he left 8 years later. He was the most admired man in the country when he won election. He was the most admired man when he left office, which gave him a stature as a former president that is also unique. I mean, he really was sui generis, I think.
Right. The only man for whom Lyndon Johnson would actually pipe down, maybe. Maybe it's fair to say.
Right.
George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, the President's Club. Also, this just blew me away. As George W. Bush's days in office began to wind down, he reached out to Clinton more, usually on weekends. The two men would talk on the phone, discussing the ups and downs of the fall 2008 campaign. Close quote. How can that be?
They met, they became, well, first of all, two things. They met on a trip to Rome for the funeral of Pope John Paul II. And they kind of hit it off.
A little piece of numerology. Of all American presidents, no two presidents were born as close together. 6 weeks apart,
in
Bill Clinton and George W. Bush.
Right. No one's even close except Carter and his father, Bush's father. So, they're two different poles of the baby boom generation and the closest born president. Now, this is the most important relationship to watch in the club now, Peter, because they become friends before the Bush presidency is over. As Hillary begins to mount her campaign for it makes some sense for Bush to cozy up to the White House, or for Clinton to cozy up to the White House. By then, Bush 43 has appointed Clinton and his father to work on projects together. George W. Bush is impressed by how courteously Clinton treats his father. And then I think the father pushed Clinton a little bit to seek George out and help him with his post-presidency.
Right.
And walk him
these
through
are both, again, these are both – this is like Carter and Ford. These are both young-ish. Well, everybody seems young to me these days, but
right,
George W. Bush and Bill Clinton could both be with us in good health for another quarter of a century.
Years. And don't forget now, 3 years out, Bush has been out of the White House for 3 years. Clinton and Bush are sort of business partners. It's kind of a new club arrangement. So they go around the country a couple times a year giving speeches together for very handsome – that's a new development for the club. They don't just have things in common about their past. They have a future together as potential – they're entertainers. They get paid six-figure salaries to go to Vancouver and Chicago and Tokyo and give speeches. That binds them in a wholly different way. So they have become friends. And because of the sort of – there's a paternity inside the fraternity – led by Bush 41, where he has his own son, his surrogate son, Clinton. And in another, his relationship with Obama is kind of interesting, too.
Tell me, Obama, of course, is dealt with least because he's the sitting president. This is still the period when all of this would be kept very quiet and so forth. Nobody, even former presidents don't say what they said to a sitting president. But where does he fit into this club?
Well, he reached out to the first President Bush very early on. He made it clear that he wanted to get to know him. In fact, one of the first things that President Obama asked after he was elected was to get the club together. And you may have seen that picture of five presidents in the Oval Office. So President George W. Bush summons the club membership. They're all there together for lunch. And after that, President Obama wants to get to know Bush 41. He goes down to his presidential library to give a speech honoring him, honoring his record in public service.
Now, that was political. Some of this is political.
It's a good brand to be associated with. I think
that's one of the things, Michael. Because they're all using each other,
and
they all know they're being used.
True.
But that's politics, and at the same time, the friendships are genuine. The patriotism. It's all very.
No,
it's wonderfully
so many
complicated.
Layers. There are many layers to this, and I think the layers. In the relationship between Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, as Michael said at the outset, that sometimes presidents from the same party have a harder time getting along.
And Obama made Clinton sign a prenup, Peter, when you think about it. Hillary comes in and becomes Secretary of State, and then before she can take the job, the Obama transition makes Bill Clinton sign an 8-point memorandum of agreement. This is new for the club, too. I think the Obama campaign likes contracts. The Obama White House likes contracts. So they make him sign a 6-point agreement about things he can't do and places he can't go and money he can't raise. And they put fences around Clinton. And they were not friends during that campaign. It was kind of ugly. And over the next year, Clinton's kind of trying to help Obama, but Obama doesn't really want his help now, 3.5 years into the first, you know, the Obama presidency. Clinton is the star of the reelection video, appearing 4 times in 17 minutes.
Final couple of questions. I love this, the notion that they get along better with members of opposite party. I think it was Warren Harding who said, my friends I can handle, but God save me. Or my enemies I can handle, but God save me from my friends.
Harry Truman said, there's no conversation so sweet as that between former political enemies.
Right, right. Who proved overall, final couple of questions here, who proved overall in your research and writing, in your judgment, the most consequential former president?
Hoover. Herbert Hoover.
He was the revelation to us, I think. Why? Is that, well, so, you know, Hoover leaves office in 1933 as just about the most hated man in America. And the Roosevelt White House wants to make sure that that does not change.
Very useful.
And so, you know, there's not so much as a birthday card. The Roosevelt White House even renames the Hoover Dam as the Boulder Dam because they don't want Hoover getting credit for this huge, you know, infrastructure project. So Hoover is completely exiled. And whenever people in the White House or the State Department are suggesting to Roosevelt, as the war is becoming more and more devastating for civilian populations, that, you know, Hoover could help with this. He knows how to do this. He was an incredible humanitarian problem solver. Roosevelt would say, I am not Jesus Christ. I am not raising Herbert Hoover from the dead. So that's where he was at the moment our story really begins.
Dead and buried.
Dead and buried. And Harry Truman has to secretly mail a letter to Hoover because he knows everyone in the White House would object to this. He's only been in office for about 3 weeks. He secretly mails a letter to Hoover asking him to come in and talk about what are we going to do about the fact that there are 100 million people in Europe who are at risk of starving if we don't figure out how to get food to them. And so you could say nothing is more consequential than an alliance between one Democrat, one Republican in a moment of crisis who end up arguably saving more lives than any two figures in the 20th century. It's going to be hard for any pairing, I think, to match the
and
impact of that.
And the worst former president?
Well, it's a close call, Peter. It's either Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter. I mean,
But Richard Nixon, I thought you just demonstrated how he was extremely helpful to Reagan.
Yeah, but Reagan, but certainly not to Gerald Ford. Certainly not to George Herbert Walker Bush, who he more or less launched an initiative against as the 1992 campaign began. Again on Russia, again criticizing Bush's slowness to move and helping Clinton that spring in ways that it was a bad scene. He was not particularly easy for Lyndon Johnson before he got to be president. You know, there were sabotage issues with the South Vietnamese. So Nixon is certainly a contender for the crown. And Carter is just a pain for everyone, and he eventually delivers the goods. But Carter is a very difficult partner, very difficult.
Okay, now television. So we have to ask if you could shrink it all down to a couple of sentences, two questions in that nature. What does the existence of this President's Club say about the presidency? The presidency, that institution, and then what does it say in a larger sense about the country?
I think what the being president is different from every other job there is that they all come out of it, even when they're successful, with welts and scars that none of us can understand, and even the successful ones. The decisions are so hard. The job is so difficult. The calls are so close. The advisors, in the end, not the ones who make the decisions. Mm-hmm. That when they emerge, and they're getting younger as they emerge, they have to live with these decisions for the rest of their lives. And so it gives all of them a place to go, a form of consolation, where the other guys get it. They understand that there are no perfect calls. And so there's a redemptive power in it, as well as a power of, you know, special missions and an office of, you know, special advice and all that.
Free parking in downtown Washington.
And as for what it says about the country, it's been striking for both of us as we were learning these stories ourselves and talking to other people, interviewing people, and now talking about what we learned, that there is such a hunger we keep encountering to see people operating in this way, to be putting aside often their own self-interest, their party's interest, making common cause in some larger purpose. Whenever it functions best, the club is always about putting the country first and helping.
Here's historian David Greenberg in the Washington Post writes a – if the review is 750 words, 725 are favorable to the book. But then he says, quote, "Sometimes the ability to overcome partisan differences can be a virtue of the highest order. But just as often, true courage lies in standing up against views held by the establishment, even or especially when you're one of its ranking members," close quote. Are there moments in here when you get the feeling that the former presidents are too clubby and too little willing to stand on conviction?
I don't think we ever saw them putting aside their principles. I think because then they would have felt they were not serving their country or their president either. I think there's a difference between what they would say in public and what they would say in private. And this is – we heard most recently this month from President George W. Bush, who, while he may not agree with very much that President Obama has done, what he says publicly is, "I don't think it's good for our country to undermine our president, and I don't intend to do so." And so you could say, is he somehow shirking a responsibility to not be confronting and standing up? I think that that's not the way they think about it. And it's not that they are naive or that they are so intent on making friends with the president that they don't speak truth to power. You know, they are power speaking truth to power. But I think they understand that the message is much more valuable when it is delivered privately.
Last word, Michael.
I found that the club is a place where they can actually go past partisanship. And maybe the, you know, Barack Obama, I think, campaigned in 2008 with a gauzy kind of loopy notion about a postpartisan America. There is no such thing. We're not heading toward a postpartisan America. But there are moments when the club is a postpartisan place. There aren't many others.
Nancy Gibbs, Michael Duffy of Time Magazine, authors of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Peter.
For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.